day, it would be extremely difficult not to lose some weight over time. As in all matters, pleasure is a key to understanding the Franco-American divide. Most American women quench their thirst with soft drinks, coffee, juices, and perhaps some tea. These are all mostly water, true, but some, especially the ones containing caffeine, are also diuretic, promoting a bit of water to be lost even as you consume some. There is simply no way of getting enough water unless you drink it straight. But it would seem that most Americans take no pleasure in pure water. They prefer something with some added taste, even if it's the taste of coffee left sitting all day on the burner or the aftertaste of diet sodas. Still, most women know they should drink more water, so they typically compromise by having a couple of glasses a day in addition to their other soft beverages. But they are only fooling themselves, and not in the good way. So, too, are those who tote around their bottle of Evian but really take just a few sips. They're not getting even close to what their bodies need to stay hydrated and to flush out toxins and the wastes of metabolism. If you want to see what water means to your skin, try adding a little to a shrunken, dry sponge. Most people don't take into account how much water we lose passively, especially in very hot or cold weather. Perspiration is an obvious debit, but in frigid, dry air, we are losing a great deal through our skin and breath. The body is not a watertight sack. The skin absorbs, but mostly surrenders water. All told, we lose about 10 to 12 cups of water a day, even when we sleep, through breathing, perspiration, and body wastes. As you can see, even the widely recommended 8 glasses a day may result in a deficit, depending on the size of your glass. The key to health and to harnessing the weight loss power of water is not radical. Just consume a bit more than you lose. In my New York office, we have a cooler with a big inverted jug, which our maintenance man keeps supplied. He once confessed to me that his life is easier when I'm not around. Since I hardly give him any work, I was puzzled. He explained with a mischievous grin, "It's the water bottles, ma'am. When you travel, it lasts a week. But when you're here, I have to change it every other day." That made it clear to me that our staff were parched by their own hands. All day long, our able-bodied crew, mostly women, but we apparently have some male camels, too, have no trouble running down to the deli to buy coffee or soft drinks. But rarely do I see any of them at the water cooler, the proverbial American gathering point for goofing off. The contrast with our Paris headquarters couldn't be more stark. Each day, a 1-liter bottle of water is distributed to each office and cubicle, and if that's not enough, and it isn't, there's a room always filled with them, where anyone can go to get more. When we have meetings, bottles are set up all over the conference room. Not in America. Even the small bottles on the conference table remain mostly untouched after a few hours, though the coffee urn is emptied and the cans of Diet Coke vanish. And it isn't just an office affair. I've stayed at lots of homes all across the United States and noticed that a single water bottle in the fridge can easily remain at the same level for days, while sodas, beer, and all kinds of sugary drinks get consumed by the economy size. Needless to say, children who don't see their parents drink water are not likely to develop the habit on their own. When I am in France and visit young relatives, I still see what I recognize from my own childhood. Everyone starts the day with a glass of water. At every meal, there's always a big bottle of mineral water on the table. People help themselves throughout the day, and it isn't kept in the fridge. Sometimes water aversion is actually an understandable distaste for suffering the shock of something cold. You might find water at room temperature much easier on your throat and teeth, not to mention your stomach. French people don't drink tap water. Ours usually doesn't taste good enough to drink. Some American water aversion is rooted in a common-sense reluctance to buy what one imagines should flow free. The great variety of bottled water may seem a feat to some. Even in American cities, there are dozens of brands on the shelf. It may seem just one more thing to lug, and obviously more expensive than what flows from the tap. In fact, you may be perfectly fine drinking what comes out of your faucet, but if you're not having your share, you need to ask why. In our house, the still waters, eau plate, of choice were Vittel and Volvic, and the only sparkling, gazeuse, brand for us was and remains Badois. We were hooked ages ago by an alliterative old jingle that ran, "A badadi, a badadois, la meilleure eau, c'est la Badois." We've tried others, but the acquired taste wins out every time. The French are the world's number two sparkling water drinkers, after the Italians. We prefer l'eau plate, but even without fizz, the choices are vast. At Colette, a restaurant in Paris, actually a store with an underground restaurant and bar, you can taste between 80 and 100 types of water from all over the world. Water drinking has become so fancy that there is now a word for the related connoisseurship, aquanomy, and water has its goût, tastes, and vocabulary. One variety is distinguished from another according to the levels of calcium and magnesium and other mineral characteristics. In case you were wondering, American mineral waters are considered bland. Could this hint at why almost two-thirds of the population is chronically dehydrated? Perhaps. But it surely must explain in part why we import so much water, not only from France and Italy, but from dozens of other countries. It amuses me in American restaurants to be routinely offered water from Fiji, an artesian variety. It could be that such delicacy about water simply goes against the American grain. Nevertheless, it's time we face up to the most widespread deficiency in consumption habits, and weight control is a good motivation, if not the most urgent. For one thing, we have to understand that the thirst sensation can often be mistaken for hunger. Very often, when we have un petit creux or une petite faim, we have in fact une petite soif. So we confuse a little thirst for a little hunger. Not surprising if we're drinking too little and are over-dependent on the water content of our food. For the same reason, water is a potent coupe-faim, hunger buster. Regularly filling your stomach with it promotes feelings of contentment and also eases butterflies. I have my own theories about getting enough. I do carry a bottle in my bag, but it's more of an en cas, not my daily supply. To get the maximum benefit, you need to drink water all day long. I have a glass when I get up, one before bed, and lots in between. I always have one 30 minutes or so before each meal. I don't need to remind myself anymore. It becomes automatic very quickly. And I avoid drinking water with my meals, as it slows down digestion. I do, however, recommend water with meals during your recasting and stabilization phases. What's lost in digestive speed is well compensated for in calorie-free volume. Sparkling water, on the other hand, is a matter of personal preference, of course, depending on the state of your digestive tract, which is not always in the mood for additional gas. Personally, I have it only occasionally, getting my share of bubbles from champagne, which has its own rewards. But in summer, I do find a glass of sparkling water with a dash of fresh lemon juice to be wonderfully refreshing. And of course, I love a citron pressé at my favorite café on the Boulevard Saint-Germain. The wonderful thing about water, apart from its total lack of calories, is that for all practical purposes, you can't have too much. It's essential to all body functions, and even the business of getting rid of it is good for you, flushing out contaminants and preventing mineral deposits. If you've ever had a kidney stone, I'm told, you'll never skimp on water again. Water also helps maintain the electrolyte balance in our bodies and can ease everything from muscle cramps, ever heard of those, to headaches, weakness, and fatigue. And let's not forget les coups de vieux. Water is my lubricant par excellence, restoring my body and soul. Adding water will do more for your complexion than all the high-tech rejuvenating molecules you can pack into a jar. If there is a fountain of youth, it's flowing with pure H2O. So make friends with water. Through healthy eating, you can get about 40% of the water you need from food, but only by eating a good variety of fruits and vegetables. Not much water in that ribeye steak. The rest is up to you. So, bottoms up. Sample various mineral waters to see if one is especially to your taste. Remember Tim Robbins and the player, ordering a different brand in every scene? If tap is your preference, invest in a purifier or filter. Remember, the French consider their tap water non potable, and even the finest municipal reservoir could use some help in the taste department. Finally, wherever you can, increase liquids that do not deplete body water. I prefer soups, herbal teas, don't personally care for the green variety despite its miraculous properties, even milk, and diluted fresh fruit juices in moderation. In France, coffee is usually reserved for breakfast and the end of a meal. We don't drink it all day long as some Americans do. That's an awful habit. If you're not having water before your first cup, you'll start the day in the red, as the caffeine drains your water reserves, which have already been depleted during sleep. Tea drinking is still not a big thing for the French. Perhaps that has something to do with British relations over the centuries. While I do notice more tea salons, black tea, I fear their job is mainly to lure tourists looking for another place to eat pastry. Tisanes, herbal teas brewed from a vast variety of plants, anything except the tea leaf, are what we enjoy both at home and in restaurants. With little or no caffeine, they are almost as good as pure water, and they have been part of our gastronomic repertoire for ages, drunk mostly after dinner or before bedtime. In my home, we were all addicted to herbal teas. Maybe it was my mother's trick to make sure we'd all drink water before bedtime, but I also remember it as a sensory pleasure. Just after dinner during the week, and later on weekends, brewing and sharing a fragrant pot was a family ritual, the day's final excuse to draw together. I loved to pick the tisane. There were always 6 to 10 glass jars filled with the dried herbs we had either picked in the forest behind my grandmother's house in Alsace or else brought back from summer holidays in Provence. From my grandmothers and aunts, I learned a wealth of home remedies. Verveine, verbena, with its lemon citrus flavor, and tilleul, from the linden tree and noted for its hint of woodiness, for any time, but particularly after a meal. Chamomile, a floral aroma with an apple-like taste, was for sleep. Menthe, mint, which is served all the time in Morocco, probably brought back as a colonial custom, would help digestion, and so on. Sometimes we'd concoct our own aromatic blends and bundle them into sachets, alongside which the bleached supermarket tea bags of today seem pathetically sterile and inert. As we sipped the last beverage of the night, we'd usually talk about our plans for the next day or something interesting someone had read or heard. It was a 15-minute social ritual during the week, but on weekends, and invariably when we had guests, it could last a couple of hours. No munching, just sipping. I particularly remember when I was a student in Paris, coming home once a month. My mother and I would be the last ones up, talking till 2 or 3 in the morning over a few cups of tisanes, and then sleeping like angels. Vivre de pain, d'amour et d'eau fraîche, goes the French saying. Live on bread, love, and fresh water. It doesn't get more basic than that. Mange ta soupe. Water, as I say, must be taken in slowly throughout the day. Soups are a great way to get it into our bodies and terrifically satisfying in relation to their calories. We French are probably the biggest soup eaters in the world. When I was growing up, it was often the evening staple. Since we'd have the day's main meal at lunch, dinner was limited to une assiette de soupe and a piece of cheese, or a soft-boiled egg, or a small green salad and then a fruit. Soups were a serious matter. They were all homemade, in les plus grands pots, which could be good news or bad depending on which soup it was, since the aromas would fill the house all day. One of my favorites was chicken, to which we would add alphabet pastina. Yvette, our nounou, dreaded the endless dinners when we lingered, making words in the soup dish. She'd try to move us along. Mange ta soupe! Good advice, actually. Vermicelle was another favorite, and so was the vegetable soup, which of course varied with the season. Soup was a wonderful staple, particularly in winter when it warmed us up. There were others, too, the ones children don't usually like, and Yvette had to find tricks to make us enjoy them. Carrot soup wasn't bad, but soups of lentils, spinach, leeks, or cabbage, their funny smells infusing the kitchen, where we had all our meals except Sunday lunch, turned us off. Eating the soup after smelling it all day was a trial for us kids, though not the adults. Yvette would make up elaborate stories to distract us, and just as she was getting to the good part, she'd say, "Mange ta soupe," compelling a few more spoonfuls before she would continue. In the worst-case scenario, definitely the cabbage soup, which we called le soupe des paysans, peasant soup. The promise of a treat afterward was the only effective way to get us to empty our dishes. It was tough training us. Poor Yvette. Her boyfriend was waiting for her, but she never knew when she'd leave the house. By the time we were teenagers, however, we'd become proper French citizens, eating all these soups, even the smelly ones, with pleasure. Making a regular place for soup in your diet is better learned as a child. But if you can do it now, you'll benefit from one basic secret of French women. If I had to pick one soup from childhood that I loved, it would be the soupe aux légumes, vegetable soup, that my mother would make for lunch in the winter maybe twice a month. It was paired with potato or apple pancakes. Basic vegetable soup serves 8. My mother cooked all the vegetables in water. Although potatoes were always included, the choice of other vegetables was often a matter of availability. Ingredients: 2 potatoes, about 4 ounces each, 1 small cabbage, 2 leeks, 2 carrots, 2 celery ribs with their leaves, 2 medium-sized yellow onions, freshly ground pepper, 2 teaspoons salt, 1/2 teaspoon dried thyme, 2 bay leaves, small bunch of fresh parsley, 10 cups of water. 1. Peel the vegetables. Cut the potatoes and cabbage into small cubes. Wash the leeks carefully and slice them crosswise. Slice the carrots and celery as well, and quarter the onions. You should have about 10 cups of prepared vegetables. Use the same amount of water. 2. Place all the vegetables in a stock pot. Season with a grind of fresh pepper, add the salt, thyme, bay leaves, and parsley, and toss with the vegetables. Add the water. Cover and bring to boil slowly. Reduce the heat and simmer for 1.5 hours. 3. Remove and discard the bay leaves. Drain the vegetables, reserving the cooking liquid. Puree the vegetables in a food mill, using the cooking liquid to thin them out if necessary. Reheat the soup to the boil. Taste and correct the seasonings and serve. At the end of the fall, Mother would add the last tomatoes of the garden, and in the dead of winter, half of a celery root. But you can add whatever you like. Same for herbs. Suit your fancy. Quick and easy carrot soup serves 4. Ingredients: 5 cups peeled and sliced carrots, pinch sugar, salt, freshly ground pepper, 1 dollop butter, fresh dill or coriander to garnish. 1. Place the carrots in a pot with an equal amount of boiling water. Cook until al dente, about 15 minutes. 2. Puree the soup in a food mill. Season to taste with a pinch of sugar, salt, and pepper. Just before serving, add a dollop of butter and some fresh dill or coriander. Fancy cream of carrot soup. Serves 8. Ingredients: 2 bay leaves, 5 cups peeled and sliced carrots, 4 medium-sized onions peeled and sliced, 2 potatoes peeled and sliced, 1 tablespoon sugar, 2 tablespoons heavy cream, salt and freshly ground pepper, whole nutmeg. 1. Bring 10 cups of water to a boil. Add the bay leaves and all the vegetables. Simmer for 45 minutes. 2. Remove the bay leaves and then puree the carrots in a food mill. Add the sugar and heavy cream and heat over low flame until piping hot. Season to taste with salt and pepper. Grate a pinch of nutmeg as garnish. Soup exotique. Serves 4. Ingredients: 2.5 cups 2% milk, 1 cup finely ground almonds, 1/4 teaspoon bitter almond extract, 1 pound haricot vert, thin string beans, 1 tablespoon red wine vinegar, 1/2 of a very ripe mango, 1.5 tablespoons fresh lime juice, freshly grated nutmeg, salt, and freshly ground pepper. 1. Combine 1.5 cups of the milk with the ground almonds and set aside to infuse for 30 minutes. Mix, put through a sieve, and add the almond extract. 2. Clean the haricot vert and add to a pot of lightly salted boiling water. Cook for 8 minutes. Drain. Rinse under cold water and puree in a food processor with the remaining cup of milk. Add the vinegar and correct the seasoning. Set aside. 3. Peel and cut the mango and puree in a food processor with the lime juice and a pinch of freshly grated nutmeg. Set aside. 4. Combine the almond milk mixture with the pureed haricot vert and serve it at room temperature in a soup dish. Drizzle the mango mixture over the top and add salt and pepper to taste. Steps 1 to 3 can be prepared in advance. For a thinner consistency, use fewer almonds and more milk, or use half milk, half water. Wine, French women, and song. Fête simple. Keep it simple, advised Escoffier, and every great cook learns to do just that. The master was most likely referring to solid food. But by my lights, the rule should also cover liquid food, which is how the French regard wine. It has calories, it has nutrients, it has flavors. Its potential as an intoxicant doesn't loom large in our thinking or drinking, as most French consider wine a sacred gift, to be enjoyed but not abused. The French poet Baudelaire said that if wine were to disappear from human production, there would be a void in human health and intelligence, and that void would be worse than all the excesses it's guilty of. We drink wine not to dull our senses, but to awaken them, and it is vitally important to our enjoyment of food. My mother, who taught me from an early age to value simplicity in all things, never served any apéritif but champagne. Her reasoning was simple. Hard liquor requires a bar, special paraphernalia, and a variety of glasses, as well as messy shaking or stirring. More important, it numbs more than it tickles the taste buds. When you've spent time and money preparing delicious food for your guests, the last thing you want is to render them unable to taste it. That will eliminate one of the most important topics of conversation. These days, after years of steady growth in wine appreciation, I notice a competing trend among Americans, a renaissance of hard liquor drinking. At restaurants, it's common, especially among the young, to order something hard while waiting at the bar, and then continue with the same drink over dinner. The alcohol content of such beverages can be 3 to 4 times greater than that of the same amount of wine, so you are getting vastly more calories, together with a duller sense of taste. Also dulled is your natural sense of contentment, and you invariably eat more. Maybe it's the key to how some restaurants survive serving mediocre food. It's certainly true that profit margins on booze are much higher than those on food. If you haven't already been converted to the pleasures of wine, you have deprived your taste buds of a world of flavors and perhaps left yourself vulnerable to seeking compensation with too much food. Wine is not only the perfect accompaniment to a meal, creating a complex interplay of tastes that stimulates the mind and offering a much more satisfying experience. It also elevates the meal's ritual value, helping you to see eating in a different light. Wine lends an atmosphere of seriousness, conviviality, refinement, and luxury, all of which counter the tendency to eat mindlessly and disrespectfully. If you've opened a bottle of wine, you're not likely to eat in front of the television. Wine can also enhance your health if absorbed in small daily doses and always, always, always with food. French women find it utterly odd to sit sipping a glass of Chardonnay as if it were a cocktail. The full taste of wine reveals itself only when paired with the right food. Aside from containing fewer calories per volume than most alcoholic drinks, fine wine is also full of nutrients and recognized to thin the blood and lower blood pressure and bad cholesterol. How many undiluted pleasures can make such claims? For Americans, the trouble seems to be either intimidation, which wine should I pick, or false assumptions. Wine? Oh, sure, we have some on special occasions. For French people, wine is a part of everyday life, and most don't fuss too much over the choices. Most French people, in fact, know only about the wines of the region they live in. Nevertheless, I believe it is an important reason why French women don't get fat. Introducing children to wine is pretty typical in France. We see our parents drink a glass with each meal, and naturally we want to taste. We were usually offered a little bit mixed with water at Sunday lunch. Sometimes, though, mischief will win out. I remember some pretty long meals with extended family, after a cousin's first communion, for instance, when some of the kids, mainly the boys, would wait until the grown-ups had got up to stretch in the garden. That was the cue to steal into the empty dining room and attack the glasses and bottles that weren't entirely empty. There was champagne, white, red, dessert wine, all of it swirled together and passed around as fast as the little scavengers could manage. Usually, the drinking party didn't last very long, but it was long enough. By the time they got caught, they were already sick, some parting with their lunch. Still, it was another lesson that can't be learned too early. Drink in moderation, and don't mix. My first official introduction to wine, it is not apocryphal, actually happened in the heart of Bubbly Land, an hour or so from where I grew up in Lorraine. There lived two of my parents' best friends, a bon vivant architect working for the city of Reims, the champagne capital of the world, and his tiny, adorable wife. She, alas, was not such a great cook, and depended on her husband as her gastronomic savior, calling him Mon Petit Jésus. He, like my father, was a member of the Pigeon Society. The Lion would come often for my mother's celebrated Déjeuner du Dimanche, when Monsieur Lion would lend his own genius to the effort, concocting with my mother ever more fabulous meals. To reciprocate the hospitality, they would invite us and other friends to Reims, where Monsieur Lion would let my mother take the lead in his wonderful kitchen. She had two kitchens to choose from. On their large estate, they had a main house and a summer cottage. The summer house kitchen was all white tile, with state-of-the-art equipment. The winter house kitchen was like a museum, with wonderful antique ceramic ovens and decor. Mamie loved it, and everyone was gaga over her cooking. A few times a year, we would leave home early Sunday morning, and my mother, given carte blanche, would cook all morning chez Lion. When the guests arrived, champagne was served, and Monsieur Lion felt the children should have un petit goutte, a tiny sip. I'll never forget it. First, he taught us how to hold the glass. It was not the water tumbler from which we kids tasted our wine cut with water back home. That was not the right vessel for the king of wines. Monsieur Lyon meant to initiate me into one of the world's great rituals. Imagine a 6-year-old holding a champagne flute, with my pudgy little hand grasping the bowl. Monsieur Lyon explained this would warm the champagne. He showed me the correct way to hold the tulip-shaped glass, by the stem or the foot. I was impressed. Monsieur Lyon was a huge man by French standards, and he had that puzzling nickname, so up until that moment I had found him rather intimidating. Now I had the little Jesus as my friend, and he loved champagne. Such delightful confusion. I still remember my first thrilling sips with the grown-up glass. For once, I had a great weekend story to share with my classmates on Monday. None of them had ever tried champagne, much less held a proper champagne glass. It made up for all the weekends I'd been dragged mushroom picking, not very cool for French kids, while my pals went to the movies. My family insisted time together had to be about food, not sitting silently in the dark watching a film. It turns out that the champagne I drank was Veuve Clicquot, and a few months later, on one of our regular visits to the Lyon, we were taken to the property of the famous champagne house. It was their favorite, and when we were ready to depart late on Sunday, Monsieur Lyon would load a case into our trunk as a thank you to my mother. So it became our favorite, too. Not surprising. Quality is never a hard sell. But little did I know that the grand name of Veuve Clicquot would become my life's work. When I was a student in Paris, after I'd trimmed down with the help of Dr. Miracle, I decided to have a party to celebrate the end of term. I blithely went to the store to collect 6 bottles of champagne. To my shock and the proprietor's amusement, I had barely enough money for one. When I told my mother the story during our regular Sunday phone call, she took pity on me and volunteered to send me a check. She had taught us the value of most things, but unfortunately not the price. That was an adult lesson. All my university friends were duly impressed. My precious offering was figuratively and literally the toast of the class. Champagne never fails to set a mood. Its festivity is irrepressible. Having learned this, I decided right there that henceforth I would either save up to have a party with champagne or have no party at all. It makes all the difference. I am truly one of those lucky people who get paid to do something they enjoy. You see, I still get a kick from champagne, a big one. To me, champagne is magic. It's also a supremely feminine wine. I love everything about it. The seductive honey color, the tiny bubbles, they should dance for you. The scents and tastes, citrus, pear, apple, dried fruit, brioche. The lovely, long, yeasty aftertaste. I love the mood champagne creates, the feeling no other wine can come close to. Celebration, life-affirming joy. I find champagne a most forgiving wine, too. The drama in the glass makes it hard to drink it too quickly, and I've never been drunk from it or had a champagne hangover. Of course, I drink it in moderation and always with food. As with all good things in life, balance is the word. For more than 20 centuries, the wines of Champagne have been present at happy occasions all over the world. But only since the Industrial Revolution in the late 18th century have we commoners had access to it. Before then, it was the wine of kings and the upper crust. For the last few decades, I have been spoiled by the chance to share an almost daily glass of champagne with someone my work has allowed me to know, whether in Paris, New York, Santa Barbara, Bali, Sardinia, Kyoto, Mykonos, Provence, Puerto Rico, San Francisco, Miami, Nantucket, or countless other places. As Edward tells me, you make people happy. It's like having a magic wand. I have always known this. When I first moved to New York, I had to visit a friend in the hospital. Naturally, I brought a bottle of champagne. French custom calls for bringing either champagne or flowers, and knowing my friend, I opted for the former. But the duty nurse wouldn't even let me through the door. It was a startling moment of culture clash. In America, with its history of temperance movements and the 18th Amendment, champagne in a hospital seems scandalous. In France, you'll often see cartoons of a doctor sitting by a convalescent's bedside, drinking to the patient's health. Today, when I lunch with friends, I find we are often the only people in the restaurant drinking champagne, even if our food is a simple platter of oysters with some great bread and butter. What could they be celebrating at noon? The people sipping bright orange cocktails at the bar seem to wonder. Life, I suppose. Marlene Dietrich used to say, champagne gives the impression that every day is Sunday. That sums it up well. In France today, champagne bars are popping up all over. The variety is wonderful. In fact, though, one of the longest-running champagne bars is in Chicago. Pops for Champagne, where I've been going for more than 20 years. Champagne remains my best trick to whet my appetite and awaken my palate. Remember, being ready for the pleasure of food is essential to contentment with proper proportion. It's also a wine that can accompany a meal, complementing so many foods. Did you know it pairs perfectly with pizza, the acidity contrasting with the oil and cheese? I wouldn't go so far as some who say it goes with everything, but it is unquestionably the most versatile wine there is. You can get fancy with different vintages and even serve rosé, or you can simply enjoy that year's Brut for roughly the price of a good bottle of still wine. Just keep it simple. Avoid serving champagne with sauces that are very spicy or heavy with cream. Also, don't pair it with the few foods that neutralize its flavors, artichokes, asparagus, and chocolate. Cooking with champagne is also fun. It's much more elegant than using a simple white wine, and as you'll need only a little, you can have the rest of the bottle with the meal. Here's a perfect recipe for dinner à deux, bound to impress your date. When I serve it to guests, they always ask for the recipe and think I've been cooking for hours, but it is done in little more than half an hour, and there is zero fat added. The chicken cooks in champagne. Cooking with wine adds flavor, but the calories of the alcohol burn off in the pan. Vermouth, Pernod, or any number of earthy reds or whites can add depth to a dish, but for elegance of finish, nothing beats champagne. I often make this dish on a workday when pressed for time, especially when entertaining on a weeknight. Once you get it going, it needs no minding, giving you ample time to prepare the rest of the dinner. The recipe makes enough for four, so I have the leftovers to make some nice chicken sandwiches. Chicken au champagne. Serves four. Start with the best and most flavorful fresh chicken you can find. Organic, free-range chicken is more widely available than ever. As for the champagne, I recommend Veuve Clicquot Yellow Label Brut. Quelle surprise! Okay, here's my disclaimer. I work for the company, but I am also addicted to its rich, full-bodied style and quality. Lots of good sparkling wines are made around the world, but they don't taste the same as French champagne. And even champagnes vary a good deal, depending on the grapes used, winemaking, and aging. Champagne has two reliable properties for cooking or drinking. The first is dryness. Champagne is an austere wine, high in acidity. With chicken, I'm not looking for sweetness, so Brut is the style of champagne that works best. Second, I consider the flavors the wine imparts to the chicken. Veuve Clicquot is notable for its rich, full body and full flavor, having been made mostly from red grapes, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier, with about a third Chardonnay. Ingredients: 4 chicken breasts with skin and bone, salt and freshly ground pepper, chervil, tarragon, or thyme, optional, 1 shallot, quartered. 1 cup champagne. Veuve Clicquot Yellow Label Brut, recommended. 1. Place the chicken breasts in a roasting pan and season them. Pour 1/2 cup of the champagne over breasts. Make a slit in each breast and insert a piece of shallot. 2. Place the pan under the broiler, skin side down, for 3 minutes until the skin is nicely browned. Turn and broil the other side for 5 minutes. 3. Remove the chicken from the broiler, baste with the pan juices, and add the remaining 1/2 cup of champagne. Adjust the oven temperature to 475 degrees and bake the chicken for 30 minutes, basting once or twice. 4. Serve over brown rice. Sautéed mushrooms add a special touch and go beautifully with champagne. In a warm frying pan with a touch of olive oil, add clean, roughly chopped mushrooms and cook for a few minutes. Add a few drops of lemon juice, freshly chopped sage, seasoning to taste, and 1 tablespoon of butter. Pour the cooking juices from the chicken over the meat and rice. Serve the remainder of the bottle of champagne, about 6 glasses, with the meal. While champagne is my first choice in wine, when it's not available or appropriate, I enjoy a glass of anything good to great, which doesn't by any means equal expensive, and have white or red favorites from just about everywhere in the world where wine is produced. I like dry whites, love a good Chablis, Meursault, or a dry Riesling from my beloved Alsace, a Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand, or an unfiltered Chardonnay from the Napa Valley. As for reds, I opt for the round, soft, light-to-medium types, such as a Volnay from Burgundy and other Pinot Noirs, or reds from Tuscany, or, for something bigger, the Rhone. I am not really a fan of those big, tannic, high-alcohol Cabernets, although some foods ask for a big one, and I love to answer. As I get older, I find sticking to 1 or 2 grape varietals throughout a meal, as opposed to switching from course to course to various wines blended from different grapes, is easier on my body, and I never touch spirits. In wine, you must learn your preferences and be ready to adjust them over time. My first choices are Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. Getting to know a few different grapes is a good way to start your appreciation of wine. Here is not the place for a discourse on food and wine pairings, but to illustrate my point about some classic marriages that are richly rewarding, I offer the following examples to get you thinking. Pinot Noir with salmon or duck. Cabernet Sauvignon with steak and grilled meats. Zinfandel with turkey, Chardonnay with chicken or lobster, Sauvignon Blanc with shrimp, Champagne with just about anything. In sum, there are 2 rules for pairing food and wine that I live by. Rule 1. Have red wine with meat, white wine with fish and poultry. Rule 2. Forget Rule 1 and please yourself by pairing any food with any wine, as long as you write the individual formula that works for you and yields the most pleasure at the table. Now, how much of a good thing is the right amount for you? On average, women just can't drink as much as men. But I find a glass or 2 a day does more than any apple to keep the doctor away. Besides, I can't really enjoy lunch or dinner without a glass of wine. Still, we all face the temptation to overdo it from time to time. Long meals in restaurants, holiday gatherings, or other festive occasions when it seems the glass is always kept full. As I have described, my own work puts me in temptation's way constantly, and too much alcohol not only loosens inhibitions, a potential professional disaster, but also encourages overeating, an equilibrium buster. I learned a valuable trick early in my career. When I first entered the wine business, I was a guest at a large champagne house where day in and day out some 20 to 30 people were guests for lunch and dinner. There was both a full-time staff and a full-time hostess and PR lady, a wonderful countess in her late 40s. One day, We were served 6 wines, with a lunch that lasted well over 3 hours. Some guests left the table noticeably looped. But the Countess got up as fresh as a rose, and catching my admiring look, took me to one side, pleased to share her simple trick. At any meal, she would limit her total intake to 1 glass, simply by pretending to drink most of the time. She recommended I watch her that night at dinner. As hostess, she'd be the one to speak, whether in welcome or to raise a toast, so she was naturally the center of attention. What nobody noticed was that she'd barely put her lips to the glass and then swallow only a drop or two. When the waiter came around with the wine, her glass was still filled, so he'd skip her and refill the glasses of the others, none of whom noticed. Some guests would have had 2 or 3 glasses when the Countess had barely drunk a third of her glass. This she repeated over the remaining courses, assuring she didn't down more than a glass in total, but never appearing less than the picture of conviviality. Without applying the Countess's secret daily, I'd never have managed to hold on to my job all these years, since, like her, I must frequently entertain at lunch and dinner. As she knew very well, when you are promoting the pleasures of food and drink, your dinner guests must never suspect you've had a 3-course meal with wine at lunch. 9. Bread and chocolate. I recently saw a short play in Paris called Les Mangeuses de Chocolat, loosely translated, Women Who Eat Chocolate. 3 young addicts decide to try group therapy, and the therapist, an ex-chocoholic herself, will try to help each find her élément déclencheur, key to getting unhooked. They all fail, surprise, and nothing gets resolved. This is French theater, but there are lots of good lines, some with more than a grain of truth. For instance, a survey reveals that 9 out of 10 people admit to loving chocolate, and the 10th one is lying. The play was satirizing a French obsession, chocolate, but also the therapeutic establishment, which perhaps one couldn't get away with in America. I took it in good fun, except when a comment was made about women who eat their chocolate en cachette, in private. To the French, the idea seems silly enough for a gag, but given my American experience, I couldn't laugh. Too often, American women eat on the sly, and the result is much more guilt than pleasure. The tendency goes with an attitude that should be changed. Nothing is sinfully delicious. If you really enjoy something, as I adore chocolate, there is a place for it in your life. But we cannot allow guilt-ridden scarfing. Only with cultivated pleasure can you enjoy chocolate in the clear light of day. The same goes for other excellent foods Americans have come to consider no-nos. French women eat chocolate, about 12 pounds a year on average. They also eat bread. We fought a revolution over it. Another item on our watch list of offenders. But French women don't get fat. In fact, here's another form of the French paradox. Pretending such pleasures don't exist, or trying to eliminate them from your diet for an extended time, will probably lead to weight gain. The only long-term effect of deprivation is the yo-yo. Down today, but up again before you know it. It's utterly pointless, especially because both bread and chocolate are good for you. If we are going to eat bread and chocolate, and we are, and not get fat, and we are not, we need to use our heads, as Dr. Miracle advised. Maximize the rewards of pleasure while minimizing the costs. In fact, he insisted little pleasures, menu plaisir, were the key to success. And according to his prescription, I absolutely needed to have my chocolate, but in little doses, par petite dose. I also had to cultivate my appreciation for what I was having. In short, he taught me the French way of enjoying those foods that can be friend or foe depending on how we treat them. The keys are sensory awareness, portion sense, quality, and an eye to the big picture of overall wellness. bien-être. I've already confessed that je raffole du chocolat, which basically means I'm a chocoholic. I'm convinced I inherited that gene from my mother. She had an amazing repertoire of chocolate desserts, as well as a passion for straight consumption. It made her the easiest person in the world to shop for. Bringing back chocolate from Belgium, Switzerland, or any good French chocolatier was a sure way to her heart. Some years ago, when a famous chocolatier in Lyon passed away in his late 70s, the obituary in Le Monde revealed he had eaten one tablette, a good-sized chocolate bar, a day for most of his life. The joke in our family became that there was now proof of at least one person in France who had eaten more chocolate than my mother. But since she would live past 90, enjoying chocolate all her days, I'm sure she beat him out in the end. If the magnitude of the chocolatier's habit doesn't sound impressive to you, your relation to chocolate must be examined. For the man from Lyon was, by French standards, extraordinary. Few of us could eat as much and still eat it properly. Not that enjoying chocolate is a competitive sport. In fact, when Mother was enjoying her fix, it was more like Zen meditation. No one talked. One look at her expressions, her lips, her eyes, commanded a hush in the house. It was a natural way of honoring our mother, allowing her the moment to savor one of her most elemental pleasures. To know how to appreciate that burst of delicate flavors, that supreme smoothness of texture as it melts in your mouth and begins its way down your throat, is to me a great accomplishment of sensual eating. It's an experience that could not be more remote from eating a Snickers bar on the run. But how did this gentle madness evolve? History reveals there are deep roots to the allure of theobroma cacao, the technical term for chocolate, meaning in Greek, food of the gods. Chocolate came to Europe via the New World, in the age of more than one discovery. The Olmecs, 1500 to 600 BC, seem to have happened on it first. Their idea of chocolate was as a high-energy drink, extremely bitter and peppery, and a sort of proto-power bar reserved for men, priests, princes, and warriors. They believed the magic food would improve war-making, sexual prowess, and one's chances of surviving snakebite. But our own version may be traced to the later pre-Columbian civilizations, around 3000 BC, when wild cacao trees grew in the warm and humid soils of Mesoamerica, modern-day Mexico and Guatemala. For the Aztecs and Totecs, chocolate was not only an elixir, but a symbol of value. Their system of commerce was based on the cocoa standard, and the chocolate produced was consumed by noblemen and merchants, all men, of course, at banquets. It was still very bitter and peppery, but it was mixed with vanilla, honey, and flowers, and served cold and foamy, usually at the end of a meal along with the tubes for smoking tobacco. Apart from its energizing powers, these blends were highly caffeinated, no doubt, it was believed to be an aphrodisiac. The Emperor Montezuma is known to have consumed huge quantities of various colors in golden cups before paying a visit to his harem. Europeans first tried chocolate following the fourth voyage of Columbus in 1502, but the Spanish appear to have been unimpressed until 1528, when Cortes brought back not only cocoa beans, but a recipe and tools for making chocolate. It became a Spanish sensation. After that, the direction of global conquest was reversed, at least gastronomically. Europe has remained a continent of chocolate fanatics ever since. Louis XIV's wife, Marie Therese, is reported to have assured the Sun King that she had no passions except for her husband and chocolate, although one wonders which she valued more. By the 19th century, no less an authority than history's greatest gastronome, Brillat Savarin, proclaimed, "Chocolate is health," and he prescribed it for many ills long before science confirmed its therapeutic properties. In its pure dark form, chocolate has indeed been shown to be heart smart, with more antioxidants than black tea or red wine, as well as lots of magnesium, iron, and potassium, all vital to women's health. It can also ease anxiety and depression, as it contains serotonin and theobromine, which act on brain receptors and have a beneficial influence on mood. As it is also high in fat, however, it is better enjoyed after lighter meals than after fat-laden holiday feasts or by itself as a pick-me-up. One of the most dispiriting developments of the 20th century was the mass production of chocolate. It created an inferior product loaded with bad fats, and as a result, many Americans have never in their lives tasted the real thing. But relief has appeared with the rise of new artisanal chocolatiers, passionate guardians of traditional methods that were perfected in the 18th century. It is to these chocolate makers, now popping up across America, that we must look for the quality that first inspired chocolate worship. My mantra of quality over quantity is doubly important when applied to something as potent as chocolate. Quality chocolate is labor-intensive and complex. It requires careful orchard selection, cultivation, and then harvest of the precious fruit. Next comes fermentation and two rounds of drying, followed by roasting and a few more delicate procedures before one obtains the cocoa mass. The proof of adequate attention and skill will be in the pudding, literally. From that mass, three products are extracted: liquor, cocoa butter, and cocoa powder. These are the materials from which the artisan works, making chocolate slabs, ganache, a mixture of chocolate with either butter, crème fraîche, or a milk product, praliné, a mixture of sugar and ground almonds or hazelnuts with chocolate, or chocolate filled with fruit or liquor. Toto, I don't think we're in Hershey, Pennsylvania anymore. In tasting chocolate, sweetness, saltiness, acidity, and bitterness are key savors. Acidity is what you should feel inside your cheeks, and it's essential to the diffusion of aromas and length of taste in the mouth. Bitterness is felt at the tip of the tongue. It signals a chocolate with little sugar, and it's a good quality as long as it does not cancel out any other sensation. Texture is also vitally important to character. Smoothness, the crunch of the shell. The artisan's ability to play with the yin and yang of chocolate, sweet-salty, sweet-bitter, acid-bitter, hard-soft, crispy, luscious, cold, warm, explains why the experience of one master's work can differ meaningfully from the experience of another's work. For French women, the real thing remains dark chocolate, bittersweet, or even better, extra bittersweet, which is the purest, with the highest percentage of cocoa solids, the stuff that makes chocolate taste chocolatey. Although you rarely meet someone who doesn't like chocolate, what the average American consumes, a chocolate connoisseur would never touch. Milk chocolate, white chocolate, or any of the various packaged forms sold in supermarkets and drugstores. This is, quite simply, junk food. Loaded with sugar, very low in cocoa content, and more often than not artificially colored and preserved. Real chocolate, like fresh ground coffee, has a very short life of full flavor. Admittedly, we French get carried away with chocolate. We have chocolate museums and clubs. We have magazines dedicated to chocolate, a Université du Chocolat and Salon du Chocolat, fairs. There are tastings and competitions for the best chocolate soufflé, the finest chocolate macaroon. Some Parisians will cross the Seine simply to buy the grain de café, chocolate in the shape of coffee beans, from a particular shop. And France being France, there is une académie du chocolat for ultimate authority. Whenever I would come home with a good report card, my mother would say, tu mérites la médaille en chocolat. You've earned the chocolate medal. It was a bittersweet compliment. In a country where national honors are routinely doled out according to connections, only a distinction of chocolate could be an honest acknowledgement of merit. The value of good chocolate holds steady. Many French women say, je déprime, donc je chocolate. When I'm down, I chocolate, meaning I splurge on the dark stuff. When you come to recognize the potential for taste pleasure and psychic relief, you will understand that it's worth the investment. Fortunately, with good chocolate, you don't need, and should not want, pounds of it for pleasure. A couple of choice pieces a day won't disable your budget or your weight maintenance program. For those not near the chocolate boutiques now appearing in most American cities, it is possible to order high quality online, such as dark, rich, delicious Valrhona. And of course, using a little food of the gods can elevate the simplest dessert to a sacrament. Here are four of my favorite family recipes embracing chocolate. Chocolate rice pudding serves four. This perfect comfort food is a wonderful winter dessert that's easy and quick to make before your guests arrive and leave on the counter till dessert time. Ingredients: 2 cups milk, 1/2 cup sugar, pinch of salt, 1 cup arborio rice, 1/2 teaspoon pure vanilla extract, 3 ounces dark chocolate, 80% cacao preferred, broken into small pieces. 1. Pour the milk, sugar, and pinch of salt into a saucepan and bring to a boil over low heat. Add the rice and cook for 20 minutes, stirring occasionally until the milk is absorbed. If the mixture becomes sticky, add a bit more milk to keep the rice creamy. Stir in the vanilla. 2. Pour the rice pudding into 4 ramekins and, using a spoon, insert the chocolate pieces in the middle of each mold and push them into the rice. Leave at room temperature. The chocolate will slowly melt and mix with the pudding. Let your guests play with the way they want to eat it. Mix the whole thing together, or start by eating the rice laced with melted chocolate and the chocolate center separately. A matter of taste and mood, and a tough decision. Chocolate espresso faux soufflés serves 4. Soufflés are easy to make once you know the technique and have had some practice, but they are not practical to make when entertaining, as they require your attention and time away from your guests. Plus, the fear of the soufflé falling is not worth the risk. Instead, here's a recipe you can prepare ahead of time for a cold soufflé that is yummy and impressive. Ingredients: 8 ounces dark chocolate, over 70% cacao minimum, 4 egg whites, salt, 4 egg yolks, 2 tablespoons strong espresso coffee. 1. Melt the chocolate in the top of a double boiler set over a pan of simmering water on medium heat. 2. Beat the egg whites with a pinch of salt until stiff, glossy white peaks are formed. 3. Whisk the egg yolks